The following Dharma talk was recorded in April 2014 in St. Louis, Missouri. It is one of two recordings from the retreat called Kind-Hearted Awareness, taught by Rebecca Bradshaw. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. Rebecca Bradshaw is the guiding teacher at the Insight Meditation Center of Pioneer Valley in East Hampton, Massachusetts. She has been practicing Vipassana meditation since 1983 and teaching since 1993. Her teaching explores the convergence of love and wisdom. More information about Rebecca can be found at www.insightpv.org.
From Tenzin Palmo, a Western Tibetan nun. Many years ago, His Holiness the Dalai Lama came to the remote Lahul Valley in India where I was living. He was there for about 1 week, giving Dharma talks and empowerments. After one of his talks, which had lasted for several hours, I turned to one of the Lahuli women and asked, "Do you know what he was talking about?" She said, "I didn't catch much, but I understood that if we have a good heart, that's excellent." And Ajahn Chah from our lineage, Thai monk. "Listening to your own heart is really very interesting. This untrained heart races around following its own untrained habits. It jumps about excitedly, randomly, because it has never been trained. Therefore, train your heart. Buddhist meditation is about the heart, developing the heart or mind, developing your own heart. This is very, very important. This training of the heart is the main emphasis. Buddhism is the religion of the heart, only this. One who practices to develop the heart is one who practices Buddhism." This word that's translated in that reading as a heart, to be fair, in many Asian countries and in the Thai language, the word for heart and mind is the same. Citta, heart and mind. And so in the book, sometimes it's translated as mind and sometimes it's translated as heart. Most of us tend to think about the mind a lot. We tend to be situated up here in our mind. So it's interesting to translate it or read the translation of heart because it puts a different flavor, I think, on our meditation. And as you saw, the description for this weekend is kind-hearted awareness. So we're going to really be including this heart in our meditation and the sense of kindness and goodwill. So to do this, I'm going to be encouraging us to drop from the head down into the heart and into the body. Somebody described meditation as waking down, not waking up. And that's the way I look at it. We're going to be waking down. And as I said, we live in a culture very centered around the head and the brain. If you ask anybody who they are, they'll point towards their head and this culture. Other cultures, they might point towards the heart. But the center of gravity that we have up in our heads is way too high for the stability and the rootedness and the groundedness that we're actually really seeking and that we need. With our stability up here, our centeredness up in our heads, I think of those big, tall punch-it dolls that have the weight in the bottom and you punch them and they come back up. If the weight was in the head, you punched them, what would happen? They would stay on the ground. but because they're weighted down low, they're resilient, they bounce back. And if our center of gravity is too high, we're like a tree without roots or a sailboat without ballast. And the winds of life knock us, come along, knock us around. And with meditation, we hope to find our ballast, our stability, our roots. So in meditation practice, we're going to be connecting with the breath as a lived experience. Even just that, trying to understand what it means to actually connect with the breath more than our idea of the breath. Even that's a major adventure. So connecting with the breath and connecting with our body and connecting with our feet and our legs as we walk. Really learning to come home to ourselves, to come home to this body that is our temple on this earth. And the stability that we're really looking for comes from the capacity to be intimate with our experience, with the whole range of experience that comes up being human, knowing how to meet and to engage with human experience. And this kind of practice, as many of you know, it's very inclusive. Nothing is left out. There's no experience that you can have here that isn't allowed or okay. It's all just very human. So we welcome all of it. We welcome the joy. We welcome the sorrow. We welcome the pain. We welcome the pleasure. We welcome the fear. We welcome the excitement. It's very enlivening. Most of you know that this tradition is over 2,500 years old, and that the Buddha was a human being like us, a human being who wanted to learn what led to the deepest kind of happiness, what he called freedom or liberation of heart, mind. He left great instructions on how to do this search. It's really one of the strengths of the Buddhist path is the precise instructions on how we meet life with balance, with stability. So the raw materials for our spiritual search are our own experience in the present moment, whatever it is. This body with its pleasures and pains, this mind that at times is calm, at times is turbulent, the heart that at times is joyful, at times sorrowful. We practice turning to all of these experiences. So I'll be giving detailed instructions based on the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness, a balanced progression and how to hold these experiences. It's especially important that you don't miss the first sitting after breakfast. I give instruction then. Actually, don't miss any of them, but that would be important not to miss. So I talked in the sitting a little bit about connecting with an anchor. We start with connecting with an anchor. And sometimes we get the mistaken notion that the meditation is about staying with that experience. So I'm supposed to stay with the breath. Most of us come up with that thought at some point, right? Or that understanding. And that's not true. It's a tool. It's a tool for helping us to come back to some sense of collectedness in the present moment. But so it's a foundation. It's a foundation of a certain amount of stability. But what we're trying to connect to is whatever is life in this moment, whatever is arising. And life includes, it includes all of our sense experience, right? It's not just the breath. When I was younger, as I said, I grew up in Minnesota. And my dad used to take us camping. And I came from a family of 8 children. And we were allowed to bring a friend. And so we'd often go camping with about 14 kids. And a friend of his owned some land about an hour and a half from Minneapolis. And we'd go there. It was fun. But what I like to do... when I got to be a certain age, maybe 12, 13, 14, I would go off to this meadow and I would sit in this meadow and I did something, I called it finding myself. And what I tried to do, I didn't have any instruction in meditation, but what I was trying to do was figure out what it meant to find myself. And I would notice seeing and hearing and smelling and feeling. And I would notice that if I had these experiences of connecting with my senses, that I would feel like I had found myself. And that if I spent a lot of time lost in the stories in my mind, I wouldn't have that sense. I didn't really understand them, but I was doing that. I was meditating. I was trying to learn what it meant to be present and connected. So a lot of our practice is figuring that out. Like, how do we connect with right here, right now? It seems like it should be so simple, doesn't it? It shouldn't be that hard. But it is hard, right? Our minds are wild. They're crazy. They go on all kinds of vacations. I was teaching a group the other night, and somebody was complaining about how much their mind thought. And I was like, don't underestimate the need we human beings have to take vacations, like to go off somewhere. It's incredible. You know, I don't know why we have to go off so much. Do you know why? It's because life is really intense. It's wild. It's changing every moment. It's uncontrollable. It's like we want to go off on these vacations and, wow, organize it all so that we can control it all. You could say that meditation is developing a greater and greater capacity to be intimately connected with this wild, wild human life. So we practice. We sit here, we walk, we come back again and again, come back to this full range of being human, and we learn how to increase that capacity of heart and mind to be open and alive and connected and here, now. Ajahn Chah says, this is how he describes meditation. He says, put a chair in the middle of a room, sit in the chair, see who comes to visit. That's what we'll be doing. We'll be seeing who comes to visit. It might be somebody invited. It might not be somebody invited. That's why it takes a lot of courage. You guys are really courageous to be here. Some people you know probably even think you're a little crazy that you do this bizarre thing of turning off your cell phones and putting away your iPads and computers and come to be with whatever visitor shows up. So the anchor, I just want to say a couple more words about it. It needs to be neutral or slightly pleasant, or otherwise you're not going to want to come back. It's hard enough to come back, but if you choose an anchor that's unpleasant, it's going to make it much harder. So if the breath isn't a comfortable anchor for you, find another one. Don't try to force yourself to stay with that experience. Or have a backup at the very least, if that one gets uncomfortable. So if the breath feels like you want to control it or it's tight, if you get into this thing with the breath, like, oh, I got him, what a lousy breath. It definitely should have been deeper, longer, and more relaxed. And then you're like, how can I make my breath feel better? And you get into all of that, that means it's not a good anchor for you. It's too distracting. It's too much of a project. It's too uncomfortable. You can practice feeling your buttocks sitting on the cushion and then your hands touching. That's just as good. Or some people like hearing as an anchor. If it's too quiet, that doesn't work so well. But you can try it. some kind of sense experience in the present tense that can be a place to come back to. So we have this connecting. We learn how to connect with life, however it's manifesting in this heart, body, mind. And then out of this connection, things begin to happen. From this openness, we develop understanding about life, our assumptions about the truths of reality, change, not self, unsatisfactoriness, these basic truths the Buddha talked about. We start to see them for ourselves. We can't see them if we don't connect. We have to connect first. We have to have that capacity to connect. Once I heard that some people did these interviews where they talked to people who had died and then come back. You know, maybe they died for a real short period of time or something like that. And they asked them to say what was important to life, you know, what they saw from the other side that was important in life. And the two main things that came up was, how did you connect or engage with life? And did you stay curious? I like both of those. To me, meditation's about both of those, how we connect and engage with life and doing it from a place of curiosity. Somebody said that word over here. I don't remember who it was, but somebody over here. Curiosity. Curiosity is, to me, the antidote to judgment. It's like, oh, what's happening? What's this? Oh, the mind's thinking, wow, what's that? What's going on? Rather than, oh, I'm a bad meditator and this has to go and I don't like it and we can't have that. And no, like, it's curiosity is like, oh, what's this? Great attitude. I read a great book called, New World, New Self, Recovering Our Senses in the 21st Century. I can't remember the name of the author, but he talked about George Washington Carver, who was a botanist and inventor, who was born into slavery here in the States in 1864. And it said that he had a genius for working with plants, and he was a real healer in working with plants. And he said, all the flowers talk to me, and so do hundreds of living things in the woods. I learn what I know by watching and loving everything. I like that line. I learn what I know by watching and loving everything. So he doesn't just say watching, loving everything. And to me, there's something about there that he's talking about this really intimate connection. And I hope that we can do the same ourselves. We can learn everything by watching and loving what arises in this body, heart, mind, what manifests as life in this particular moment. I'm going to encourage you to, as you already know, to unplug, disconnect, tune into no agenda time. Many of us in this modern world are busy, busy-holics. I know out east particularly, people are, wow, so busy all the time. And I was wondering if it was different here in St. Louis, but I think from the conversations I had at dinner, it's not. This is what it's like in many ways. This is a interview with Robert Iger, the CEO of Disney. It was in the New York Times. He was asked, what are some things you do to manage your time efficiently? He said, I get up at 4:30 every morning. I like the quiet time. It's a time I can recharge my batteries a bit. I exercise and I clear my head and I catch up on the world. I read papers. I look at email. I surf the web. I watch a little TV, all at the same time. I call it my quiet time. But I'm already multitasking. I love listening to music, so I'll do that in the morning too when I'm exercising and watching the news. That's modern life, right? All right. So we have a different idea of quiet time here. I'm going to encourage you to have a technology cleanse. And for some of you, that might be hard. Instead of working on the gross national product, we're going to work on the subtle national product. So it's great. Here we get a chance to live life at a slower pace and to connect from that place. And anytime you might still feel speedy on the weekend because it's a habit, but you can make that a mindfulness bell when you notice a sense of speediness, leaning forward, having to get somewhere, whether it's to whatever's next, or even in your meditation where there's this leaning forward, like I have to get something from my meditation, like I have to get it now because there's only 3 days. You know, even when you notice that kind of like leaning forward, use it as a mindfulness bell to settle back, relax, receive life as it is. An interviewer once asked Mother Teresa what she says to God when she prays. "I don't say anything," she replied. "I just listen." Then the interviewer asked her what God says to her. "He doesn't say anything," said Mother Teresa. "He just listens." And if you don't understand that, I can't explain it to you. Isn't that great? It's a little bit like what meditation is like. I was thinking recently about I don't know if those of you who are my age, you probably remember Carlos Castaneda's books. Those of you who are younger, you might not remember. But when I was a teen, there was this American guy named Carlos Castaneda who supposedly, it's never been proven whether it was true or not, but he was supposed to have studied with this shaman in Mexico. And I loved the books. I devoured them. They were in my parents' library. And there's this one story where Don Juan is the name of the shaman. So Don Juan tells Carlos Castaneda, he has him out on his porch, and he tells Carlos Castaneda to find his power spot. And he tries to get Don Juan to give him more instructions, and Don Juan's not going to give him any more instructions. So he's trying all these places on the porch all night long, trying to find out like where his power spot is. And finally he gets tired and worn out, and he just sits somewhere and he goes to sleep. And the next morning Don Juan comes out and he says, "Oh, I see you found your power spot." And sometimes I think of meditation like, in some ways, it's finding our power spot. Maybe it's where we finally decide to sit down. Maybe our meditation cushion is our power spot. I know that when I was a child and all through all my life, but especially I remember times when I was a child where I tried to find power spots. Every time we moved, I'd find a power spot. My first one was under a tree in the yard. There was a big hemlock and I had a little cave in there. I was like 6 or 7 and I would go hide in the cave there. And then I lived near Lake Harriet in Minneapolis. So I'd go down to the lake and sit on one of the trees. And then that place in the woods when I was camping, that was a power spot. And then when I was 18, I worked in Yellowstone for the summer. And I worked on the canyon and at the canyon. I was just in a gift shop. It wasn't an exotic job. But I would go sit out on the canyon and there was this point that was a little jutted out, and I'd sit right on that point. And again, I try to figure out, like, what does it mean to be here? I knew I wanted to be there. And I would, like, without any instructions, trying to figure out, what does it mean to be here? How can I be here? You know, it was like this magnificent place. And then obviously the mind would do its things. But it felt like a power spot. And even when I lived in big cities, I lived in Madrid for a year. And I would still find little green triangles, like, and I would sit there, like in the middle of the city, and just try to figure out, how do you be here? How can I be here? You know, all the cars and the cacophony of city life. And now where I live, I like to go out. I live in the country, so I go out in the woods. I have power spots out in the woods, and they're just places that I sit, and I just sit, and I suppose you could say I meditate. It's not very formal. But I definitely want to be there and figure out what that means and how to be there. And what we learn about life by being here in our power spots. The best thing is to have a portable power spot that goes everywhere with you. So the great thing is that we have everything we need. You have the exact ticket that you need to develop love and wisdom. You don't need anything else, this body, this heart, this mind, whether it's a young and healthy body or one with chronic illness, whether it's a joyful heart or one that's suffering from anxiety right now, it's all the ticket we need. So we turn and, include everything with a kindness-infused awareness. So that's what I'll be talking about, a kindness-infused awareness. And out of that, transformation happens. Awareness does so much of the work. We can do a lot less work than we think we have to do. Most of the work is just showing up, establishing an intention to be here. And then a lot of it's out of your control, so don't beat yourself up if it doesn't seem to be going the way you think it should. It's not hopeless. It's not that out of control. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here, right? The first time I meditated, I decided it was impossible. I was living in Nicaragua. I was 23, and I had this great book by Steve Levine, A Gradual Awakening. I still think it's a great intro book. So I get all ready. I'm sitting here meditating. So I meditated for 5 minutes. I was like, this is impossible. Nobody can do this. I couldn't follow half a breath before my gone. And so then I signed up for the 3-month course after that sitting. The 3-month retreat at IMS. I figured I needed some work, help. And actually, I learned later that was actually a good meditation, because I was seeing clearly what was happening in my mind. It just wasn't what I thought should be happening in my mind. I thought I was supposed to be able to stay with the breath, and that was clearly not happening. But I came back a lot of times in that 5 minutes. That's a good meditation if you come back a lot. It's good. So much to say, I'm just trying to decide which parts. This is life training that we're getting. We should have gotten in kindergarten, but we didn't. So we're all in the remedial class. There are these programs where they're teaching kids like 4 years old about compassion and mindfulness. It's so great. There's this movie that came out. What's it called? I can't remember, but it's Richie Davidson and those people at Madison were put out this movie. And I saw a trailer when Richie Davidson came to our town and gave a talk. I saw a trailer for the movie, and there's this little kid. His name was Willie. He was 4 years old, and he was diagnosed with ADHD. And apparently he had a lot of trauma around elevators. He got caught in an elevator once that wouldn't move or something. So at the beginning of the movie, he's sitting here and his teacher's sitting here and she's like, Willie, you want to go to the beginning of the trailer. I only saw the trailer. She's like, Willie, you want to go to the elevator? He's like, no, he's really upset. He's like, I know. And she's like, okay, no, we won't go to the elevator. Don't worry. And so then they taught him about, emotions and mindfulness. And what they did is they give these kids these snow globes, you know, the globes with the snow in them. And they say when your emotion's really strong, it's like when you shake the snow globe. But if you sit and you hold it, like the flakes will like settle down. So then later in the trailer, she's like, Willie's sitting there with his little snow globe. She's like, Willie, you want to go to the elevator now? Are you ready? And he's like, yeah, I'm ready. She's like, you want to bring your friend? She's like, yeah. So they're walking down the hall and they go in the elevator. He's standing there and she's like, how do you feel, Willie? And he's like, calm. It's great, you know, like, wow. Got some good training, huh? He had his power spot with his little snow globe, his portable power spot. So what do we get for this willingness to meet life? We get a ever-strengthening sense of strength of heart and mind. Strength and courage, fearlessness, compassion, and a ever-increasing sense of peace because we were willing to open to life and to meet life and meet it as it is, not as we wish it would be or want it to be or think it should be or hope for it to be, but how it really is. And out of that comes this deep sense of peace. So what we will do in a few minutes is take the refuges and precepts. Is there anybody who's not familiar with the refuges and precepts? Don't be scared to put up. Okay. So one of the traditions in Theravada Buddhism, especially, is taking of the refuges and precepts, and we often do it at the beginning of a retreat. And there's a couple of reasons why. One, because of the kind of work that we're doing, this meeting all of life, it takes a certain sense of safety, courage and safety to sit here. And the refuges and precepts create a kind of container of safety for us and for our community. So the traditional refuges are the refuges of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. We can look at these in different ways and find how it connects to us. So the refuge of the Buddha may be that some people really connect with the person the statue supposedly represents, connects with this person who lived this long ago, who really looked deeply into this issue of suffering and how to free the heart and mind. Some people might not be so into the Buddha, but might have their own religious figure or secular figure, somebody that they find as a manifestation of enlightenment that inspires us. So in some ways, this first refuge can inspire us. What's possible? One of my most recent heroes is Malala from Yugoslavia. I don't know how many of you know of her, but she's this young 16-year-old. She wrote a book called I Am... Well, she didn't write it. She got help writing it, but it's called I Am Malala. And she was shot by the Taliban when she was young, maybe 14, because she was an advocate for women's right to have education, because the Taliban was trying to close all the schools for the girls, was bombing them, which is pretty effectively closes them. And she was just, even though she knew that she was in danger, she kept advocating for women's right for education. And then there was this interview she did with John Stewart that was just the best. He's like, well, what would you do if the Taliban came now and wanted to, you know, shoot you now? She said, I'd take off my shoe and I'd hit him over the head. No, I can't do that. That wouldn't be right. That would make me the same as them. She said, I would tell them about education for girls, and I would say, if you have a daughter, I want her to get education too. And then I'd say, now do what you need to do. So much courage. Like, after she was shot badly, she had a lot of surgery. And so then John Stewart's sitting there and he's just like, do you think your dad would mind if I adopted you? That's great. Absolutely great. When you're off this retreat, go Google it. Anyway, she's just, to me, she's like 16 years old. She has an ancient, ancient soul. Just amazing. Anyway, whoever inspires you. And then also the Buddha, the taking refuge in the Buddha is also our own, taking refuge in our own capacity to awaken. And you must have that or you wouldn't be here. So to remember that we have some faith in ourselves and our capacity. Taking refuge in the Dharma. Traditionally, taking refuge in the Dharma means the teachings or the truth. So we can take refuge in the Buddhist teachings, or we can take refuge in the truth of our own experience. It can teach us everything. And the third refuge is the refuge of the Sangha, which traditionally is the monastic order. But many of us think of taking refuge in the Sangha as taking refuge in community of other practitioners. So we could think of it, we take refuge in each other this weekend. And you'll find that when you come in the hall and everybody else is here, it helps you. It's like, oh, I can do this. There's that sense of community. Or when you maybe don't feel like going doing walking meditation, but you see somebody else doing it, it's like, oh, I can do that. So we encourage and help each other. It's harder. If you were the only person trying to sit here and do your weekend retreat, it would be harder. So we help each other. So those are the three refuge, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Then we take the five precepts, and the precepts or mindfulness trainings are five guidelines for helping us to take care with our actions so that they reflect compassion and non-harming. So it's really a training in ethics, ethical conduct. And the five precepts are great because they're places to point to say, be careful here. This is where you could easily cause suffering. This is where you want to really watch your actions so that you bring happiness into the world and not pain. And so the first precept is to refrain from killing living beings. Now, mostly I'm not worried about you killing each other, but the little beings. I just had an experience of this. I moved my pillow in my room and there was a bug. And and my first instinct is, how can I get rid of this bug, right? Like, that's our instinct, right? And then I was like, oh yeah, precepts, right? And so I tried to take a little sheet of paper. I was going to take the bug outside. He got away. He didn't look like he was going to. He looked like a pretty harmless bug, really. But it was, you know, I remembered the precepts. They're great. They're like these little warning flags, like, pay attention here, pay attention. The second precept, refrain from taking that which is not given to us. So basically, refrain from stealing. And I'm not worried about you guys stealing from each other, but again, it can be refined, like taking care with other people's things not to borrow somebody's something or the other without asking. Can be refined even further in taking care of how we use the earth's resources, what's given to us. All of them can be refined so much. I love the practice of the precepts. I think it's a huge part of our practice. And there won't be time this weekend to talk about everything, but. So the third precept is to refrain from causing harm, with our sexual energy. And on retreat, we take the precept of celibacy. And the reason why is, to help us understand this energy. Sexual energy is one of the most powerful forces in this universe. And, refraining from it helps us, if it arises, to see and understand it and understand how it can be related to skillfully and in ways that bring joy. But on retreat, it's, we refine it that way. In daily life, it's take care with our sexual energy. Don't cause harm here. Use it responsibly in a way that brings joy and connection. The next precept is to refrain from false speech. So, refrain from telling lies. It's interesting, isn't it? It seems like a little thing, but it's the foundation of so much. What we give with the precepts when we keep them is we give people the gift of fearlessness and the gift of trust. And when we break, and when we tell lies, we take that away from them. I read somewhere that somebody said, I think it might have been Benjamin Franklin or somebody like this. No, it probably wasn't him. I can't remember who it was, but he said to somebody who lied to him, he said, I'm not so upset that you didn't tell me the truth. I'm upset that now I can't trust you anymore. I thought, wow, what a way to put it. So when we tell lies, people can't trust us. When we tell the truth, they can. We make it easy here because noble silence, you won't be talking very much. But there will be question and answer periods. There'll be your groups. And it's just to look at whether we're really telling the truth or being honest. There's so many ways we can stretch the truth, right? I do it in Dharma talk sometimes. I'll catch myself. I'm saying something and like I'll exaggerate a little bit. And then sometimes I'll stop in the middle of Dharma talk and I'll say, you know what? That's not true. It's actually this. it's that some kind of urge that we sometimes have to like look better or more impressive, right? Like to exaggerate something a little bit. So there's so many ways we can look at this precept too. Other ways that we cause harm with speech and how we can use it in a way that's loving and brings kindness into the world. The last precept is the precept from taking intoxicants which cloud the mind, to refrain from intoxicants which cloud the mind. So basically, on retreat, we're here to develop clarity of mind so we don't want to take drugs or alcohol, things that would cloud the mind. If we're on prescription medication, please keep taking it. That doesn't apply. A retreat is not a good time to stop taking medication that we usually take. That's a whole interesting exploration, too. We can talk about what we ingest, alcohol or drugs, but also food that we ingest. Do we take food that's nourishing or food that's harmful? Or movies and books and entertainment that we ingest? We can watch, we can learn about that. You'll learn about it this weekend. You know what'll be going through your mind? What you put in there is what'll be going through your mind. I learned that first 3-month retreat. I had had nothing to do the summer before, so I lived at my dad's house. And I'd watched a couple of soap operas the first 3 weeks of that retreat. It's like, oh, I wonder if she's with him. And I wonder if they found out that he did that. And, you know, it was just like, I'd be like, I don't want to be thinking this. But it's what I'd put in my mind. I learned a lot. I learned a lot. I made a vow to never watch another soap opera. So those are the five precepts, and they're, as I said, they're trainings, they're mindfulness trainings, they're practices, and it's great to start those practices here, and then, some people take them at home. They take them home and they work with them. Use them as a big part of their mindfulness practice. In the context of retreat, it's a gift that we give to each other, a gift of safety by taking these precepts. Are there any questions about the precepts or anything else that I've said tonight? Okay. So we will chant them. Did you bring them? Do you have them with you? We'll do a call and response, so don't worry if you don't, but... So I want to reassure you that taking the refuge in the precepts doesn't make you a Buddhist. It can if you want it to, but it doesn't necessarily, so don't worry about that. We're welcoming to folks of all religions here, and all religions benefit from mindfulness and kindness and all the qualities that we're trying to develop here. So even though we are, this is a Buddhist retreat based in Buddhism, and we do have the guy sitting up there, the statue of him. It's just represents qualities that all religions value. Okay, so, the first part is the homage. We'll do the first time call and response, and then we'll do the second and third time together. Of the refuges, we'll do the first one, call and response, and then the next two we'll do together. And then the precepts, we'll do call and response. I like to put my hands in Anjali. You can, you don't have to. Namo tassa, namo tassa, bhagavato, bhagavato, arahato, arahato, samma sambuddhassa, samma sambuddhassa, namo tassa, bhagavato, arahato, samma sambuddhassa, namo tassa, bhagavato, arahato, samma sambuddhassa, buddham saranam gacchami, buddham saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Sangham saranam gacchami, Sangham saranam gacchami. All together. Dutiyampi buddham saranam gacchami, Dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami, Dutiyampi sangham saranam gacchami, Tatiyampi buddham saranam gacchami, Tatiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami, Tatiyampi sangham saranam gacchami, Panatipata, Panatipata, Vairamani, Vairamani, Sikkhapadam samadhiyami, Sikkhapadam samadhiyami, Adinadana, Adina dana, Vairamani, Sikkhapadam samadhiyami, Ve ramani sikapadam samadhiyami brahmacharya. Ve ramani sikapadam samadhiyami. Ve ramani sikapadam samadhiyami. Musawada, musawada, ve ramani sikapadam samadhiyami, ve ramani sikapadam samadhiyami, sura meriya, sura meriya, majapamadatana, majapamadatana, Ve ramani sikapadam samadhiyami. Ve ramani sikapadam samadhiyami. Irame silam. Irame silam. Magapalanyanasa. Magapalanyanasa. Pachayo ho tu. Pachayo ho tu. Thank you. The last line there that we chanted says, may this morality of mine, I think is maybe how it's translated. The word morality doesn't always work for us. But may this commitment to a life of non-harming, may it lead to the deepest fruits of practice, is what that last line says, and it's intimately connected. So great practice, the practice of the precepts.